There is a long tradition of the study of Sikhism in Western academia. However, historiographical accounts still lack a clear vision of the early formation of the tradition. Rahul Deep Singh Gill addresses this lacuna in Drinking from Love's Cup, Surrender and Sacrifice in the Vars of Bhai Gurdas Bala. Through a detailed analysis and lucid translation of the literary tradition of Bhai Gurdas Bala, who died in 1636, the tradition's most important poet, Gill challenges and critiques current modes of Sikh scholarship. Bhai Gurdas's poetry shaped early Sikh theology and practice, providing an emotive lexicon for communal identity. Gill highlights some of the most important of Gurdas's vars in articulating key themes in his writing, including spiritual death, martyrdom, sacrifice, and divine love. These tropes often emerge in the context of relationships with Sikh leadership, such as the martyr Guru Arjan or his son Guru Hargobind. In our conversation, we discuss the state of Sikh studies, the founding tradition around Guru Nanak and the transformations that shape Gurdas's life, the Sikh canon and its broader textual landscape, Islamic influences, the manuscript tradition, practices of feet veneration, scholarly Orientalism, translational practices, and interfaith engagement. I'm one of your co-hosts, Christian Peterson, and thanks again for listening to another episode of New Books in Religion. Without any further delay, here was my very fun conversation with Rahul Deep Singh Gill. Welcome, Rahul Deep. Thanks for joining me on New Books in Religion. How are you doing?
I'm great, Christian. I've been looking forward to this for so long. I am a longtime listener, first-time caller. I'm a big fan of the show, and I really appreciate that you're interviewing me today. I appreciate the service that you do to the field for talking to people about their books.
And past hosts, you did one episode with
Dr. Isaac Weiner.
Yeah, about his great book.
Yeah, he had a great book, man. Super interesting book about religion and sound in American history. People should really check that out.
Well, as you know, you're always welcome to come back and co-host the channel if you want. So,
but it was really fun. I think I might do that. I might take you up on that offer.
Well, today we're talking about your great book, Drinking from Love's Cup. But before we get into this, we want to know a little bit about you and your background. So, could you tell us a little bit about how you got interested in the study of religion, perhaps mentors, moments, texts that were really influential in shaping either how you approach the study of religion or the types of topics you're interested in?
Well, I started reading Victor Turner when I was in preschool, I believe. No, man. I do not come from people who, you know, do PhDs in humanities, right? My grandfather was a small farmer in East Punjab. My dad and mom immigrated to the United States, you know, worked multiple jobs to get us through. I went to college like every other South Asian kid, supposed to be a physician, you know.
You're I was quite the failure.
Totally failed, man. This is Plan B.
Yeah.
I remember telling people in high school, you know how everyone out of high school is asking, oh, what are you going to study, you know? I remember having like this really serious, I don't know, I was like pitching myself to people, right? Like, I want to understand what makes humanity tick was my like tagline, you know? Like, I wanted to do pre-med, but I didn't think that I was going to actually major in science. I was going to like do something else. I tried psychology. Psych 101, sorry psychologists out there, Psych 101 might be the worst course to introduce people to the study of psychology. I did fine in it, but it just wasn't interesting. Took an anthro class, and this professor had like amazing stories about working with shamans in South America, and he told them in the most boring way, you know. It was the most dry class. And then at the end of my freshman year, I took this course with a professor, Ann Meredith, at the University of Rochester. It was a it was a freshman kind of seminar course, and it was called Quest for the Historical Jesus. And I was kind of religiously illiterate, like in terms of like other faiths, you know, going into college in a lot of ways. And that, not only did I, you know, get an understanding of what, you know, the basis of Christianity was and stuff like that, but that you could ask questions related to the quest for the historical Jesus, right? That assumes that there was a Jesus of faith and a Jesus of history and like these kinds of questions. I was like, I thought I was in some huge secret. You know what I mean? Like, I was like, wow, you can do this. Took a couple other classes. I took a class on the Quran with a mentor of mine, Emil Homran, who you know from Islamic studies. He's got another great translation out about Sufi poetry. And Emil, man, he taught a hard class. That was the hardest B+ I ever earned. But, you know, I just fell in love with the study of religion, and it fell in love with me. I ended up TAing the most difficult class in the major, theories of religion. I remember when I took the class, I did my presentation on William James's Varieties of Religious Experience, which I will never forget. I spent, you know, probably like 90 to 100 hours in a matter of like 2 weeks digesting that book and recapitulating it for the class's digestion. And at the end of it, Bill Green, great scholar of early rabbinical Judaism, held up and then dean of the University of Rochester, the college, and now provost at University of Miami, held up my paper and went to the class. This is how you write. And I just remember like melting, you know, like, oh my God, I can't believe it. I was doing mediocre in sciences, Christian, and I was kind of killing it in the study of religion. And I went through a really crisis moment of like, oh my God, what am I going to do? Like, I love studying this stuff. I love teaching it. I was a TA. And I remember in that class, we also read a book by Eugene Gallagher and Tabor and Gallagher's Why Waco, about the Branch Davidians and the crisis and how that was, you know, all went to hell. And I remember thinking, man, somebody wrote this book and intervened in this very important moment in American history and was trying to intervene on the side of the, you know, for the purpose of, you know, reducing this conflict. And the conflict ended up happening anyways, but there's people out there working on this stuff. And we know we were just like a decade and a half out of the Indian government's and Indian Army's invasion of the Darbar Sahib, known as the Golden Temple Complex in Amritsar. And I remember putting these two things together, like, wow, somebody's speaking up for a minor cult in America, in Texas, right? And like, who speaks for this this religion of 25 million people in Punjab when their, you know, most important shrine and shrines around Punjab are eviscerated by the Indian state? I just remember thinking, there is power in the academy, you know? So not only do I do well in studying this stuff, it's important.
Well, you've done a great job producing this book too.
Thanks. Yeah, I've been studying Gurdas since that time. The summer after TAing, Theories of Religion, I went to the winter after that, I went to Punjab and studied at the feet of one of the preeminent historians of Sikh history, J.S. Grewal, and in Chandigarh, where I was born, where my family's at. And I was trying to understand, you know, what Sikh religious identity was. And I remember Grewal telling me, you know, don't look at these 19th century sources if you want to understand Sikh religious identity. And he said in the Queen's English, I remember him sitting in his living room and he had this cardigan on and, you know, totally this British educated Punjabi professor. He said, Rahul, have a look at Gurdas to understand, you know, 17th century Sikh identity, early Sikh identity. And that was my honors thesis. My college honors thesis was understanding Sikh identity creation through looking at Gurdas's vars. And I've been having a look at Gurdas for more than a decade and a half now.
Well, many listeners might not be familiar with Sikhism in general or in particular. So before we kind of get into Gurdas and the specificities of his life and writings, what do we need to understand about the tradition to think about your project? What can you tell us about the specific historical moment in which Gurdas was living? What were the conditions and transformations that would have shaped his life?
So Gurdas is living and writing 100 years after the founding of the community under Nanak, also known as Guru Nanak, known at that time as Baba Nanak, right? Guru Nanak, Baba Nanak founds this community, and he says he does so after having received a call from the Lord to be a minstrel at God's court. And so Guru Nanak's compositions are poems. Many of them are vars, actually, in the var genre, like Gurdas writes. Guru Nanak's poetry compositions form the basis of what is today Sikh scripture. The first, the penultimate manuscript of Sikh scripture was compiled during Gurdas's time, and many say Gurdas served as the scribe or maybe amanuensis for that scriptural text in 1604 under the aegis of the fourth successor of Guru Nanak, right? So Guru Nanak founds a community, dies in 1539, passes it on to a successor, and then that succession continues 9 times further. So there are 10 gurus in Sikh history. Gurdas writes, I argue, immediately after the death of the fifth guru. And so the community has enjoyed 100 years of success. That success has also drawn the ire of the Mughal Empire, which is founded almost exactly at the same time as the Sikh community. And by the time the fifth guru, that his sort of mini kingdom is thriving, the Mughal emperor sees enough of his political and religious authority to feel some sort of challenge, and he ends up having the fifth guru executed, Guru Arjan executed. So my argument, and this is the first time anyone sort of argued this about Gurdas, is that because the subtitle is Surrender and Sacrifice in the Vars of by Gurdas Bala, that Gurdas is writing about the surrender and sacrifice of Guru Arjan, which happens in 1606, 2 years after that manuscript is completed. And Gurdas's Vars are a very direct response to that event. Now, a lot of people no one's sort of seen them as a direct response to that, and there's a bunch of complicated reasons in history why I argue that is the case. But when I read Gurdas, I see him making very beautiful literary allusions borrowed very much from the Islamicist tradition, Sufi traditions, particularly Shia traditions, talking about the cup of martyrdom, the cup of love, as a metaphor, as a stand-in for the notion of surrender and sacrifice for a higher cause.
Now, could you tell us a little bit about Gurdas? How has he generally been understood in Western scholarship? How does he understand himself through his writing? And what would you say, how would you argue we should understand this figure?
So Gurdas has been called by some the St. Paul of the Sikh tradition. He's this lofty literary and religious figure who people revered so much that they never ended up taking seriously, if that can be believed. That is to say, they found his writings to be so important and so powerful in edifying something about Sikhism that they never really tried to understand what animated those writings. And so there's these stories that emerge in the 18th century about who Gurdas is that become, like 100 years after his life, that become the sources for later history about Gurdas. Those stories kind of portray him as a scribe, as somebody who's very devoted to the guru. But what I argue is that Gurdas sees himself as a bard of the guru. Now, this has precedence in Sikh history because Guru Nanak sees himself as a minstrel of the Lord, right? So poetry, especially the var form, heroic poetry, has a place in the spirituality of the Sikh tradition. And I argue that Gurdas is very much utilizing that heroic art form of the var, which can be kind of translated as a ballad, to really make a statement about the import of Guru Arjan's death and sacrifice and what it means for the growth of the Sikh community. Now, at that moment in time, that would have Guru Arjan's death, murdering the leader, right, of a tradition would have been the most traumatic event in the history, in the short 100-year history of that religious group. So what Gurdas is doing is transforming the emotions of that event into a heroic act that he argues in his poetry is sort of seeding the what he calls the banyan tree, right? The banyan tree that will grow to become the future Sikh tradition, which will provide cool shade to this burning world. So he sees that, this event is a momentous occasion and something to be celebrated, no matter how traumatic it appears in its time.
Now, can you tell us a little bit about the manuscripts you're looking at? Because these early writings, there's a few editions. Tell us about the text you're working with. Give us an idea of what those texts are like, and who would have been the audience for these.
So those are multiple questions.
They are. Answer them now.
And the reason why it's difficult. So the reception history of Gurdas is something that I can theorize about. I can hypothesize about at this moment. I would need to do a little bit more work in getting the story straight to really dig into especially that first 100 years of reception of Gurdas, which would have been really important. Manuscripts wise, the tricky thing is while Sikh scriptural manuscripts have colophons and are pretty, are much more easily datable, none of Gurdas's manuscripts before the 19th century have any kind of datable information in terms of the manuscripts themselves, right? So what I noticed when I was looking at the manuscripts and traveling archives in Punjab was that the numbering of the manuscripts was kind of sticky. There were a few manuscripts, at least one that I saw at the Khalsa College in Amritsar that started in a different order than the others. I later found another one in Javadi Kalan that started with the same var, and this var was what is today the fourth var, and it's about martyrdom. It's about sacrifice. It's about terrible things happening and then amazing things coming out as a product of that. At the University of California, Santa Barbara, the Center of Sikh and Punjab Studies there had a copy of a manuscript that I call the Lamba manuscript that was in the possession of one family. It had a facsimile of that manuscript that also started with that var, and I could see was like an earlier version of whatever that later the Javadi manuscript that I had found. So, make a long story short, there was at least three manuscripts out of all the ones that I studied that started in a different place, had a shorter number of vars, but sort of alluded to the notion that these were the complete vars of Gurdas, which means that that scribe, whoever that scribe was, thought that he had all the vars that he had. And in those manuscripts, there was only 34 vars. Today we have 40. So what I found was that there was two kind of recensions additions or whatever you want to call it, of what Gurdas's corpus was in terms of the vars. He also had another set of texts in Brajbhasha. There are quatrains called gabits. Some of them are saveyas, for those people who know a little bit about the Braj quatrain system. But I argue that I think those probably came at a later date. The vars were some of the earliest things that he wrote, or that at least that are extant.
Now, as you describe his writings, you place them within the context of this more settled Sikh scriptural tradition. And you talk about how sometimes he's understood as writing commentaries, basically, that his writing is part of an exegetical tradition. So, you've kind of alluded to this in bits and pieces, but kind of help us fill in the gaps here. What, how should we understand Gurdas's vars? What are the contours of the broader Sikh textual canon that we should know about? And where would you say that his vars fit within this textual landscape?
I would say that they're the first non-canonical poetry that the Sikh tradition that emerges out of the Sikh tradition. So we have prose texts that are basically that we call the Janam Sakhis, that are retellings of the lives of the Sikh gurus, beginning with Guru Nanak, that emerge at some point late in the 1500s. But Gurdas's that are the first extant poetic texts outside of the canon of the Guru Granth Sahib, which is the Sikh scripture. Now, if you have an exegetical text, typically exegetical texts, if the notion is that they're explicating and clarifying something that is unclear in scripture, those are going to be prose texts, right? In some sense, that's the role that the Janam Sakhis are playing, that those life stories or those prose life stories that the gurus are playing, is that they give an episode of the guru's life and they say, oh, here was the scripture that was, here was the hymn that was revealed at that moment, and this is why. What you have with Gurdas are beautiful poems, very complicated poems with their own intricate landscape of literary allusions and forms that I think whoever's writing this is not trying to explicate something that is already there in scripture. By the way, Sikh scripture is written in a very rustic and understandable, kind of poetry itself. Gurdas's poems are much more, I would say, military in their cadence. Because he's writing in a genre known that is like a ballad form, they're a lot more energetic. I would say that Gurdas's writings fit as the first writings to understand what is happening in Sikh history, right? The first poems to understand what is happening in Sikh history. And they are emotive, right? They're not rational and logical and boom, 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 this is an argument. they're very emotive and emotional and trying to get the, you know, a rise out of the audience. So I would imagine that these were performed orally. And there's a great tradition of minstrels and bards in Punjab who performed love stories, stories of battles and things like that. And I think this fits into those genres much more so than exegetical texts.
Now, to get to some of the content here, you describe his vars revolving around a few tropes, specifically this idea of suffering in kind of spiritual and material ways. And then this allusion in your title, Drinking from Lover's Cup. So how does Gurdas incorporate these themes of spiritual death, sacrifice, martyrdom, love, in his writings? And what would you say is the context we should think about these in?
So I think the context that we should think of when we're looking at this is the context of Ishq, right? Of rapturous love with the divine that the Sufi tradition, particularly out of Persia and Afghanistan, is so well known for. So the idea of, you know, Al-Halaj or Mansur, right, as the person, this Sufi that says, you know, I am the truth, right? And then he's put to death for that. I think, what was it, Abbasid caliphate maybe? And he becomes a point of allusion for later Sufis who say that he has, you know, drunk from the cup of love and he has reached fana. You know, he has obliterated his lower self. And so Sufi poetry celebrates his death as a kind of act of defiance, but also as an act of deep devotion to God, total love with God, as a kind of drunkenness. And so in Sufi spirituality, the notion of spiritual ascent is very deeply tied with metaphors of intoxication, right? Spiritual intoxication. So Gurdas uses this word. He doesn't use the word Ishq, which comes from the Persian Arabic setting. He uses the Indic word Biram and Bram, which is, right, a kind of a synonym for Ishq, love, the kind of love in which one gives up for the beloved. And so Biram Piala, the cup of love, is a constant theme in Gurdas's poetry. Drinking from love's cup allows us to be fearless in the face of great suffering. It allows us to bear the unbearable. And so for me, that really is very close to somebody being put under unbearable conditions until that person dies. And that is what happens to Guru Arjun by the orders of the Mughal Emperor Jahangir. He is put to death. And so I'm saying that Gurdas is celebrating Guru Arjun's death, the most traumatic event up until that point in Sikh history, through this lens of wine and drunkenness and martyrdom that is so rich in Shia and Sufi traditions that had reached Punjab, you know, centuries earlier before that.
So what does he say in his text then? He talks about these in kind of relation to kind of personal aspiration and kind of religious life. He talks about this in relation to the guru leadership. Can you give us a little more detail on what he's saying about these things?
So what he's saying is, look, these are trying times, right, is what he's saying to his audience. There's a var stanza, the 26th var stanza 27, in which he says, the fish never leave the ocean regardless the calamity. The moth knows no love other than the flame, right? So these are metaphors of total devotion, total surrender, surrender up until the point of death for the beloved, right? The moth to the flame. I would imagine that some Sikhs are probably rethinking their loyalties in an event after an event so traumatic as the death of their guru at the hands of the state, right? So one thing that he's saying is, hey, don't leave this community. Another thing he's saying is, don't leave this community for a rival group. So Guru Arjan's brother, Prithi Chand, and then Prithi Chand's son, Guru Arjan's nephew, Mehriban, they have split off and have said that they are now, after Guru Arjan, the rightful heirs to Guru Nanak's, you know, spiritual legacy. Guru Das is on the side of Guru Arjan's son, Guru Hargobind, who is even more political than his father, militarizes the community in some sense in response to his father's death. And Guru Das is saying that this increased politicization, this more defiant stance, is actually the Sikh way, right? And the way that he does this is through deep metaphor. So in that same var 26, stanza 12 says, "Wondrous is the sugar cane which grows with its head down." Again, act of devotion, act of surrender. "First its skin is stripped, then it is cut into pieces and crushed. Crushed in the juicer, it is mangled. Its juice goes into a cauldron, boiled, enduring every agony. It is hailed the world over as jaggery, molasses, sugar, candy. The Gurmukhs, the Sikhs, joy fruit is the sweetest of all. Drinking from love's cup, die and find life again, like the sweet sugar cane." You see what I'm saying? So he is giving metaphor after metaphor of the sweetness of a death that comes in the face of great difficulty, in which one does not leave one's devotion to the guru or to the divine.
This is great. And you, we should mention here that a large portion of the book is these translations of the vars themselves. So maybe this would be a good point to talk a little bit about that translation process. Both why did you think it was important for these primary sources to be available in English, and talk a little bit about your process in producing them?
Well, for me, it's my own act of defiance against a kind of Orientalism that has enveloped the study of many religions, right? But that still is deeply ingrained in the study of Sikhism. The I don't know if you can believe this, but the person who is the father of the field of Sikhism, Hugh MacLeod, a New Zealander, former Christian missionary, died within the last decade or so, started writing his first book in 1969. His autobiography is called Discovering the Sikhs. You know, and on it is an image of him in a beret meeting a Nihong Sikh, like the most, right, the 0.01% of the population who still walk around like, it, you know, it's 1690, partying like it's 1699, right? Like they're still living in this military lifestyle. They look a certain part. And I think that out of his legacy, Sikh tradition is still deeply ingrained with a kind of Orientalism. Now, most people's answer to Orientalism is to move away from texts, right? So we want to understand how people actually live their lives instead of these idealized versions that come out of the textual traditions. I argue that the textual tradition of the Sikh tradition was never properly studied, right? And we have so much work to do to even date the basic texts. And so for me, trying to understand what these people were saying in their time is actually a way to counter that particular strand of Orientalism that is in the Sikh tradition. Now, with respect to Guru Das, because his poems are so pithy, right, because they're so loaded with metaphors, translating him was a particular challenge in the midst of the always difficult, if not impossible, challenge of translating from one language to another. And so I chose a style that tried to mirror his pithiness, that tried to write in plain English, in plain language that was understandable, that didn't need, you know, a dictionary to read. And I really tried my best to mimic rhythm whenever possible, because these vars, as ballads, as very much performed texts, are ultra rhythmic, right? The onomatopoeia inside of things, inside of lines, the internal rhyming, the way stanzas are constructed. Often the last line in a stanza is the shortest line and has the pithy truth of that stanza, right? For example, let me find one. You know, talking about the you know, six hovering like bees at the guru's feet. One stanza in the seventh bar ends, hovering like bees merged with joy. Boom. End of stanza. Right. So it was very important for me to get that sense of that shortened line, even if it, you know, required me to not be as verbose and trying to explain every little thing that was in the originals. And I try to do my best of using footnotes and stuff to explicate allusions whenever they were important to explain to the audience.
Yeah. Was Boom the last part of what he wrote?
No.
Is that your edition? That's
how I read it. Boom.
You should. It's it comes across in that way. You have effectively constructed the language to come across in a moving way. So,
oh, thanks, man. Well, you don't know Punjabi, so you don't really know if I did a good job.
But I know English. yeah, I don't know if it's accurate, but the way it reads in English is very good. One particular chapter that I found interesting, not knowing a lot about the tradition, that others might also enjoy hearing about, is one focused on feet. So could you talk a little bit about how Gurdas understood and legitimized practices revolving around feet?
So this is var 23, right? And this is a perfect way to talk about how the way that we've interpreted Sikh texts within the tradition, as well as in scholarship, as well as in that Orientalist scholarship, but even, you know, Sikhs themselves, we're kind of blind to some of the realities that were alive at the time of when they were written. I was working with a hunch that came from my mentor, Grinder Mann, who thought that there was an initiation ceremony in the 17th century in which the Sikhs didn't dip the toe of the guru and drink the water like a lot of other traditions do, right, for initiation. They washed the feet of new initiates and then drank that water. Now, okay, fine. 2017, not hygienic, right? Like, you know, we got to get over our whatever, you know. A lot of times I tell people that, and they're like, ew, gross. Okay, fine, gross. But what that tells me is that a couple things. For this tradition, washing the feet of others was an act of hospitality, right? It was an act of, again, trying to obliterate the caste system or its influence, which was a deeply important part of the founding of Sikh tradition with the institution of langar, right? People sitting on the floor eating together, irregardless of gender, social, economic distinction. And so through this process of falling at each other's feet, they would literally also touch each other's feet in greeting. Sikhs would, according to Gurdas, he writes, we fall at feet and bring the world to our feet, right? That it's the Sikh worship of each other's, you know, the divine in each other, that is a practice of deep humility, but also a practice of caste defiance, that are going to cause the Sikh community in the future to be very successful, right? We fall at feet and bring the world to our feet. And he goes through all of these metaphors like the goddess Lakshmi, the river Ganga, and says, you know, people say that these things are pure, but even these, even the river Ganga, right, comes out of Shiva's, what is it? The river Ganga, elixir of the celestial feet, renounced the heavens for the earth. So this is an allusion to the Ganga in one myth. That is, the river is said to flow out of Vishnu's left toe. So he like is bringing all these allusions in and says, see, feet in all of history have actually been the most important thing. And we are six. We worship feet, and we worship the feet of others, and we worship the feet of the new initiates. And we think of them as our guru. Like, that is like a mind-blowing description of what might have been lived religion in the 17th century, right? So for me, the texts are not only beautiful and they're alluding to something, but they're also describing, I think, what might have been a practice that has been lost over the centuries, that probably was a controversial practice because it was kind of gross, right? Or for whatever reasons. But this is Granada saying, man, this is what we do. This is what Sikhs do.
Now, there's so many directions we could go, and again, you've done a great job translating this. Is there any kind of specific vars that you would like to highlight before I let you go?
You gotta look. Don't let me go. You know, I just love var 26. It's I call it bearing burdens with love's cup, and it's a var that talks about the royal nature of Guru Hargobind, right, and how formidable he is, and how he's facing burdens after the death of his father, including, right, striking this defiant tone against the Mughal emperor, and then having to battle his own uncle and then cousin for the role of guru, right, in the 17th century. So, you know, in this context, I think really trying to understand var 26 is essential. So let me read you one stanza, the ninth stanza of var 29, and it's going to end with that short line at the end. And just remember, keep in mind that this is a moment of deep fear, probably for the Sikh tradition, of when they feel burdened by the trauma of the death of their guru. The state is persecuting them. There's a rival sect that is trying to pull people away. And Gurdas writes, "Those who feel love do not fear. The loveless will fear what comes after here. Fire burns, water cools. One swells up, the other stays low. Full pots drown, but light ones float. The weighted vat makes no music. The mango tree heavy with fruit bends low. The high bear only pain. The bird of the heart soars from tree to tree, eating wherever it finds fruit. On the scales of justice, we who will sink." "On the scales of justice, we find who will sink and who will rise. The victorious will lose. The losers shall win. Feet will stand on heads. We fall at feet. We win the world." Stanza 9 of var 26 of Gurdas's var.
Well, Rahuldeep, it's been a pleasure. Before I let you go, can you tell us a little bit about some of the things you're working on now or hope to have come out in the future?
Well, I'm not trying to write $99 books anymore. you know, I'm trying to write. I want to translate more of the Sikh tradition's poetry. That's going to be a slow process and a long process, especially to find a publisher that will publish it in a prestigious form that is also, you know, something that you can pick up at Barnes & Noble. And is available to a mass audience. But other things that I'm working on right now are things that emerge kind of out of teaching at a small private college in Southern California, like, you know, trying to work on interfaith cooperation in these crazy times and this era of, you know, inflamed bigotries that we live in. So I speak on these issues. I consult. I'm campus interfaith strategist at California Lutheran University, where I work. So that now that I'm coming back from sabbatical after a year, is going to be taking a lot of my time. During sabbatical, I did some writing. Actually, an article just came out in the Journal of College and Character. So not related to the Sikh tradition, not related to 17th century Sikh poetry, related to very much the 21st century issues of how we teach religion and how we build a resilient student body on our campuses in these times of increased bigotry and political contention. So check that out. It's called From Safe Spaces to Resilient Places, and Journal of College and Character just came out. So I'm working on a couple different things, Christian.
It's great. It's important work. And I wish you the best of luck, my friend.
Thanks, Christian. Thank you so much. Thanks for having me. Thank you to all listeners who were with me talking about this book. And hope to do this again.
Yeah, we should. That was my conversation with Rahul Deep Singh Gill about his great new book, Drinking from Love's Cup, Surrender and Sacrifice in the Vars of Bhai Gurdas Bala, published with Oxford University Press in 2017. Thanks again for listening to another episode of New Books in Religion. We'll see you next time.